Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
And speaking of that, we have some of the top Atlanta legal experts here in our studio here this morning for Atlanta Legal Experts. Rich Casanova here, your co-host, or actually your host, filling in for Emily Rao. She is traveling somewhere on the globe. And Emily, I hope you're enjoying at least one day off for this week. And again, Rich Casanova here, the producer, engineer, co-host, and will be hosting this morning's show. And for this morning, we have a great panel of experts in the Atlanta legal arena. We want to first mention the show this morning is brought to you by Peachtree Offices, 3A Law Practice Management, Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, Equitable Payments, Global Payer Funding, and U.S. Legal Support. You can find all of their information and links to their website at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. And let's just say hi to our folks joining us in the studio briefly here. So, Katie, how do you pronounce your last name? We didn't practice that before we went on the air.
I know. It's intimidating. It's Cannell.
We got talking about fireworks and the 4th of July and everything else. So, Cannell?
Cannell. Yes.
Okay, nice. I'll mispronounce that later, but for right now, I got it correct. And what will you be chatting about this morning?
I am an attorney practicing exclusively in domestic relations.
Oh, okay. So. Nice. Okay. And so I'm sure you'll have some stories. And you practice in several states. Is that correct?
Or No, just Georgia.
Just in Georgia. Okay, yeah. I'm thinking of our next guest, Sharon.
Good morning, Rich.
To the show.
Thank you.
So how many languages you speak, but let's talk about how many states you're practicing. Yeah.
So I'm actually licensed in 6 states, but okay. I practice throughout the country.
Wow. And you're joining us with what firm?
I work for a firm called Levy Konigsberg. I'm a one-woman branch office here in Atlanta. Our home headquarters are in New York City, and we specialize in asbestos litigation.
That was my next question. Very well done. All right, and also joining us in the studio is Larry Christensen. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We had a chat. I think you won the award for earliest arrival this morning.
I think I did.
And got us coffee. You're all set up to go. And what area of practice and who are you representing or with?
Our firm represents injured and disabled children and adults in Social Security disability cases and some related matters.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's one of the first questions we were going to kind of chat about, the difference between Social Security and...
SSI?
Yeah.
Well, Social Security disability is an insurance-related program by which a person can earn work credits.
Right.
And having worked enough, one attains a insured status. SSI, on the other hand, is a welfare program for children who have obviously never worked, or for adults who have never worked outside the home and earned any work credits.
Right. We'll be getting into that conversation here in a moment. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. All right. And so our first guest we're going to be chatting with this morning is Mark Thomas, a graduate of East Tennessee University and Mercer University's Walter F. George School of Law. You began your career as a law clerk in Houston County. And
make sure you say Houston.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what I was going to say, yeah. I stand corrected. Houston County, yeah. All right. And before switching to the practice of personal injury law as a defense attorney for insurance companies, in 98, you opened your current firm. And you're a member. You practice in Sandy Springs, where I live. And you live over that way as well?
That's correct. 2.8 miles from my office.
Nice. Yeah. Not a bad commute. Yeah. I'm making everybody else jealous in the driving in this morning right now. You're also a member of the GTLA, the WCCL, which is, I know the GTLA, but...
That's my workers' comp section. Okay. That's a group of us workers' comp lawyers.
All right. And as I mentioned, you're the Sandy Springs Bar Association as well, as well as the Atlanta Bar Association mm-hmm. and the Lawyers Club of Atlanta. Also a volunteer citizen patrol with the Sandy Springs Police Department. Those are the cars. I've seen those driving around the city. So that's you in the car?
Well, last week it was me directing traffic for 3 hours at Abernathy and Roswell Road during a thunderstorm. But usually I'm riding in a car, yeah.
Yeah, that hit pretty bad in Dunwoody, especially, right? Mm,
right, yeah. And it was at Sandy Springs. It turned an entire light pole around, so we had to go down there and direct traffic for several hours.
Oh, man. Good stuff. So when you're not directing traffic and putting out fires, so to speak, So your emphasis is representing injured workers, we were talking about.
That's correct.
Okay. And how did that kind of come about, or how did you find that direction?
Well, I've always represented, started out as a defense lawyer years ago for a temporary personnel agency, and it represented basically hundreds of folks that had been injured, and I was defending the temporary agency. And I just got tired of billing hours, Rich. I don't really enjoy that very much. So I like the story. I like the person. I like the individual. So I like to get to know the people. I couldn't do that as a defense lawyer, so I like to help people. And the only way I could do that was to become a contingency fee plaintiff's lawyer.
Okay. That makes sense. I'll concur with that. So in business, I have, you know, everybody has a number of pet peeves, right? So in the area of practice of law, what are some that come to mind?
Well, probably a big one for me is, and even if I don't want to, I return phone calls. And I think I get a lot of clients as a result of the fact that I actually speak to clients. And I think a lot of lawyers, unfortunately, don't do that. And that's a pet peeve of mine, not just in the legal profession, but just period. If I like return phone calls, and I always do that. So I'm accessible. Communication is a big part of that.
So when people don't return your phone call, what happens? You go knocking on their door?
I know some people from Jersey, and I don't do that. But.
We often ask attorneys, Yellow Pages aren't around anymore, right? I guess they still are.
They might be around.
They might be around.
I was at one point I was in 35 of them back late 90s. So yeah.
Yeah, I remember I had a company out in California, and you literally had to cover every book, anywhere in your area code.
Right.
So today, how do you obtain your clients traditionally?
Well, most of because I've tried that model. I've done the TV. I've done billboards. I've done phone books. So the best way to do it is what we're doing right now. Communication, talking, networking, meeting other people. I get most of my clients now, since I've done this a while, from other attorneys and former clients.
Yeah, what type of attorneys then?
People like Larry Christensen over here, Social Security lawyers, disability lawyers, other personal injury lawyers that don't do workers' comp. Labor lawyers are good referrals for me.
All right, we should do a show with just all those folks in the studio.
I would be happy to be here for that.
I would imagine so. So we kind of ran through a little bit of your bio, but how long have you had your practice or been in practice in your area special?
Well, this particular practice, Mark Thomas and Associates, I started back in 1998, and I started downtown Atlanta, and finally 4 years ago moved it to Sandy Springs, where I realized, hey, wait a minute, I can actually live close to where I work, so I moved my office. But I've been out of law school since 87, so I've been practicing for longer than that, but this particular firm began in almost 15 years ago.
So do you ever get over to Houston County anymore?
I have not been to Houston County in a while. Basically, the judges that I worked for in 1987 are still there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And what are other areas of law have you practiced?
Well, I've done a little bit of everything, which can be dangerous.
Right.
At one point in time, I had a general practice in Marietta, actually, and did... wills, divorces, DUI pleas, plaintiff's work, personal injury, workers' comp, just about anything. And I like to specialize in one specific area. So,
I mean, I don't know if you really make that conscious effort or decision, but I think that definitely kind of, behooves clients that work with you to be able to have that kind of experience, because you can kind of draw on that. But I think you need to kind of land on the niche and area that are an expert in, right?
Right. And Rich, too, I'm really good at knowing what I don't know. So I know a lot of people that do the things I don't do. Right. But you're right, I do. It's nice to have the ability to say, well, yeah, I did those before. I've done divorces. I'll refer you to someone, but I can give you kind of an overview about what you might expect.
Well, yeah, especially because if you've had your hand a little bit in divorce issues, then you kind of know, based on their situation as you know it, you can probably better refer a good fit for that specific divorce attorney.
Absolutely, and I'll refer it right next door here to my co-panelist.
All right, nice. So talk to us about pitfalls that injured work, somebody is an injured worker or on the other side for companies, what are some things to look out for, or some indicators, or I guess after it's occurred, mm-hmm. what's some things, people, mistakes I guess they make?
Well, I think an important thing, just like I touched on earlier, is communication. It's important in a workers' comp scenario to make sure, first of all, unless they have to go immediately to an emergency room, to make sure that they report the injury. And make sure, as I tell every client in any type of case I've ever done, whether it's workers' comp or personal injury or anything else, the number one priority is their health.
Right.
And that's number one, is to concern themselves with getting better. And that means the treatment is as immediate as possible. And a lot of folks don't do that. And they make sure, they need to make sure that they take care of themselves.
Right.
That's the number one priority.
So kind of hypothetically, or a case scenario, so someone gets injured at work, what's kind of the protocol they should take other than needing to go to the emergency room? You said report it to their supervisor, to HR. Should they get it in kind of writing? Because you could say, well, I told Bob or Susan that I was hurt, but it's he said, he said, right?
Generally speaking, the supervisor would be the best person just to go tell. If you hurt your back or if it's an obvious injury, then certainly go to the hospital. But yes, tell the supervisor, hey, I've been hurt. I need to see a doctor. Hopefully the supervisor or HR or whomever will say, we have a panel over here on this wall that, pick a doctor from that panel and go see that doctor. And, we'll take care of it. And hopefully usually people don't need me.
Right.
Because most employers do the right thing. So they do get their injured workers to the doctor.
So long as I visit a medical profession, that's kind of the record of the injury or situation. You don't need something, written as I'm in pain. Here, sign this, supervisor, right?
Yeah, not necessarily.
I mean, you wouldn't draw up a document as an employee.
No, not necessarily. And I tell clients this as well, or potential clients, that they can go to any doctor they want to. They don't have to go to the workers' comp doctor, but if they want their employer to pay for it, they need to pick one of those doctors.
Well, and finally, in this day of age of video everywhere, I don't think you can, leave your home without being on video, right?
Right.
So how does that impact your business? There must be a number of times where, is there typically, say, out of 10 cases, is video usually come into play or not necessarily?
Because
they'd have to have security cameras all throughout.
Depending on the workplace, generally not.
Right.
Although I did have a case a few years ago with a package delivery company, and we had a video that was about 45 minutes long.
Wow.
And it was a fight case. There were two people that had that fought, and my guy got conked over the head. And at the exact minute that they were about to start the fight, a truck pulls right in front of the two combatants, and then the truck pulled away, and we saw nothing. So, but it does come into play periodically. However, I have received back in the old days, and now just by email, videos of my clients doing a lot of things they shouldn't be doing. So that, not necessarily video at the workplace, but maybe video surveillance later comes into play.
Yeah, big time. So what's anything in the future on the horizon, like new laws coming into place or new procedures or affecting your business?
Well, the actual minimum, they was $500 a week. It's gone from $500 to $525 to $550 in terms of the benefit. So the weekly benefit has gone up a bit here lately.
All right.
All we're trying to do as workers' comp attorneys is just to keep the system in place, quite frankly. That's kind of what we're working on. In terms of anything new, there wasn't a whole lot of... I actually did the legislative update down at the State Bar Convention last year, and there wasn't a whole lot to talk about.
Right.
So we're just trying to maintain the status quo. And there was a little bit... There put some benefit tweaks here and there, but I don't want to bore your audience with all that.
All right, we can post that on the site. So... So tell our folks, our listeners, what's the best way to reach out and, contact you?
Sure. Contact me at either by phone at 404-523-8000 or mark@markthomaslaw.com. And I'm also on Twitter and Facebook page.
Yeah, I saw that on M.W. Thomas.
At M.W. Thomas, yes.
On Twitter, okay. So we're already doing some social media here on the show, so tune in for that. And thanks again for being in the studio and on the show, and stick around. Maybe we'll have some follow-up questions from our expert panelists here.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, so next joining us in the studio is Sharon Zins.
That's right,
I get that right? Okay.
Yes.
And you represent individuals and families, as we mentioned before, affected by asbestos-related illnesses, and in 20 different states, as well as around the country or throughout the country.
I think it's been about 20 different states at this point.
Right.
We pretty much litigate wherever our clients are. If someone's been injured and they've been exposed to asbestos and they have an asbestos-related illness, we'll go to whatever state they're in. A lot of my time is spent picking up and flying around the country.
Oh, really?
People.
Oh, wow. And you recovered multi-million dollar settlements for your clients. Your license, as we mentioned, to practice law in California, Florida, Georgia, New York, New Jersey, and D.C.
That's right.
All right. You attended Emory School of Law, active member of the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association and the Georgia Association of Women Lawyers. In your free time, you enjoy running, yoga, volunteering with the Atlanta March of the Living. You don't do running yoga. That's two separate
Those
things.
Those are two separate things.
All right. I'd like to see someone do that, right?
There is a big practice of yoga for runners,
okay.
But you don't do them at the same time.
Nice. Okay. That's what I was hoping. What's this Atlanta March of the Living?
So the March of the Living is a program that takes students in high school to Poland and then to Israel to learn and commemorate World War II and the Holocaust.
Oh, wow. How long have you been involved with that organization?
I attended the program when I was in high school in 1998 out of South Florida. In fact, everyone in my family has attended the program at some point. And the Atlanta community is trying to increase its presence in the program. So I've been helping out a little bit with that.
Sure. And have you had the opportunity to travel as well? Or
I don't anymore.
Okay.
Maybe one day. I'm hoping to go back on the program as an advisor.
All right. Nice. So now asbestos litigation. Tell us what led up to that, or your background, or your credentials, or how did that kind of evolve?
Sure. So when I graduated from law school, I had some westward dreams, and I moved out to California. I knew I wanted to represent individuals who needed help, and I knew I wanted to be in the courtroom and do trial work. And I found a firm that did asbestos litigation, and it was a really great fit. I found that I really loved my clients and I really believed in the cause. There were a lot of people over the years exposed to asbestos who didn't know that they were being injured.
Right.
And years later are becoming sick. So it was a great fit. Kind of fell into it. But since then, for the last 10 years, it's been the focus of my practice.
What are some symptoms that people would have related to that illness? So
there are three main illnesses that asbestos causes. One is asbestosis, lung cancer, which a lot of people know about, and a disease called mesothelioma, which is a kind of cancer, and it's a kind of cancer that is only caused by asbestos.
Oh, wow.
So people would really find out from their doctor that they have one of these illnesses.
All right, and how big, I don't know if this is a fair question, but how big is asbestos still? It seems like it's been eradicated to a good amount, or no?
It has, thankfully. It's not illegal in all products in the United States, but it's been banned from certain products.
Right.
Its height of use was in the 60s and 70s, and it's not being used nearly as much in the United States now, almost not at all in the United States
right.
now, but certainly in Canada and in India, very much in China. There's still a huge use of asbestos, and a lot of our experts that we use in our cases spend their time going to these other countries to lecture about its dangers.
So just from a civilian standpoint, so buildings, residential, commercial buildings built before around the 60s or 70s, could they still contain asbestos?
Absolutely. If you look around the skyline of Atlanta, you're sure to see buildings that were built with asbestos in them. Thankfully, if it's in the walls and you don't touch them, it's not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
It's when you are working with it that it becomes a problem. So, for example, the people who built the buildings along the Atlanta skyline
right.
may be the ones who now are going to become
okay.
sick.
But, is it not in the ventilation system or whatever?
No, thankfully. Okay. Once it's sealed into the wall, you're pretty much okay.
Oh, okay. Is there a situation that would arise, I guess, under remodel or construction or at some point that it needs to be, removed? Because it seems like you hear these stories where there's cases where they come in and need to remove it, right?
Absolutely. And if you suspect that there's asbestos in a building or in really anywhere you are that you need to do some remodeling, you won't stop.
Right.
Call someone, and you might get someone out to your house in one of those spacesuits to do the abatement work. And there are some companies around Atlanta who do that work.
Oh, that specialize.
That specialize in asbestos abatement. But generally, it has been abated in large part, and people are not really doing the kind of construction today that would expose them to asbestos.
Okay. And was it equally kind of used commercial and residential for the most part? Or
absolutely. Asbestos was used in all kinds of products. And so we see folks who were auto mechanics in the 60s, 70s, right, and 80s who were exposed to asbestos from the brake linings that they were using.
Really?
Really. And in fact, we call them shade tree mechanics. You take your own car out into the shade of your front yard,
yeah,
and you're doing your own brake jobs, you know, a couple times a year. That's enough to expose you to,
wow,
asbestos and cause disease.
Yeah, because obviously I've been focusing on buildings, and you just mentioned the auto industry. Is there any other things that the average person wouldn't think that would be affected?
Absolutely. We have a lot of clients who served in the Navy.
Okay.
In the boiler rooms and in the piping all over Navy ships, there was asbestos. There were actually some talcum powders that both men and women would use that were contaminated with asbestos. So we have some clients who their only exposure to asbestos was from
talcum powder.
From
like
their bath
innocent
time every,
yeah,
day.
Yeah. How did that come about? They're just produced in the same facility or something? Or seems like an odd mix, whatever, right?
That actually happens because of the mining process of talc. That particular mine where it came from, and several different mines where it came from, were contaminated with a particular kind of asbestos.
Okay, so let's get back to the kind of the law discussion. So someone feels like they're affected or has an issue. What are some important criteria in selecting a lawyer like yourself in terms of an asbestos claim?
Sure. It's very important to talk with a lawyer who specializes in asbestos litigation. There are a lot of firms who advertise that they handle asbestos cases, but really what they do is they pick up the phone and they call me or someone like me. There is a lot of science and medicine that's involved in handling an asbestos case, and it really takes a lot of time and preparation to become an expert in that science and medicine.
Seems like, again, it could be, you know, rather expensive, or the perception to be able to hire an attorney like you that's so specialized in a certain area, and it seems like you're fighting not a lost cause, but, you know, as an individual. So, I mean, what if someone can't afford, you know, a lawyer like yourself?
Sure. And you're right. These are somewhat expensive cases,
yeah,
and you are fighting sometimes against some pretty big companies.
Exactly.
Companies who our listeners in Atlanta would recognize even as some local companies. We take all of our cases, much like Mark here does, on contingency fee.
Okay.
And that way, everyone, no matter what your financial ability is, has the right to bring a lawsuit for their own injuries. There's no cost to any of our clients up front. That way, no one feels like a lawsuit is out of their reach.
Yeah, and along that line, I've seen on TV, you see about this fund being set up for this issue. You know, what do you know about that?
Sure. A lot of companies do advertise that there is this victim compensation,
right,
fund. It's actually a little more complicated than that. A lot of companies that have been sued because of exposing people to asbestos, when they declare bankruptcy, they set up trust funds that you can apply to. And there are probably 50 or more of those funds out there right now. So even if that company that caused you to be exposed to asbestos is out of business, you may still be able to get some compensation from them.
Really? If they're no longer in business, where's the money going to come from? they'll find it from the owners or the...
These funds are set up when they go bankrupt or they go out of business. They set up these funds, and instead of filing a lawsuit, you can make an administrative claim to the funds.
So someone that files a claim, do they automatically, they need to go to court? I mean, what's the protocol or process for that?
So a lot of these cases do go to court and do go to trial, but you aren't necessarily going to have to see a courtroom if,
okay,
you bring a lawsuit. You can apply to some of these funds as an alternative source of compensation. So if going to court or going to trial is a little bit scary right. to someone, that's not necessarily something that you have to do.
Yeah, it does seem kind of like, you know, one person against these huge firms, and it doesn't seem like you can win. But that's where you need someone like yourself on your side or whatever that knows the ins and outs and has, you know, studied or practiced in this area specifically for so long.
That's exactly right. And it, although it seems like we're a little bit of a David and Goliath situation, we find that we are tremendously successful for our clients. These are very serious injuries, and they're caused only by this one very harmful product and a very harmful mineral, asbestos. And so ultimately, we end up with pretty significant recoveries for our clients.
Right. Well, I guess that's one thing that's kind of unique about your practice is that it can be narrowed down to an exact specific ingredient or product. There's not a lot of, gray area there, right?
That's right. The gray area sometimes comes in figuring out exactly which product you work with that contains asbestos. But everybody knows that it is the asbestos you were exposed to that caused your injury.
So very impressive, your knowledge and area of expertise. So how would folks get, our listeners, get in touch with you?
The best way to reach me is just to call my office, which is 404-748-1600. 404-748-1600. And as Mark was saying, returning calls, I think, is one of the most important things in my practice. And you can always expect to hear back from me right away.
Well, I definitely appreciate that as well, because, I mean, there's a great use for the internet and emails, all that good stuff. But sometimes you want to be able to talk to a person, know that they're there to help you. So appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Absolutely. So up next, Katie, welcome back to the studio. Taking some good notes there?
Yes, I've got lots of questions for everyone.
All right, great, great. So just a reminder, listeners, you're listening to Atlanta Legal Experts, and Rich Casanova here, your host for today's episode. And Katie, you're an attorney with the law firm of Boyd, Collar, Nolan, and Tuggle?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and you've practiced domestic relations exclusively during your career with a focus on divorce support and child custody, as you mentioned. You're the current co-chair of the Young Lawyers Division. Family Law Committee for the State Bar of Georgia, recognized by your peers as a super lawyer. I always love that term, whatever. I wanted to be a super lawyer. There's no cape or you have any like secret, what do they call it, superpowers or anything or no?
No, I wish. I think that's just more of an accolade given by our peers for being involved.
Yeah. Big time. It's awesome. Kudos and congratulations on that. And that was for the Rising Star for 2014 and 15. Currently serves on the Fulton County Family Division Task Force, dedicating your service to Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation. Regularly speaks and publishes articles on issues related to family law, finances, child custody, and litigation. Welcome again to the show.
Thank you.
So let's talk about family law.
Oh, well,
how did you, as I ask most attorneys, how did that find you, or did you find that area?
I actually found family law. It is something that's kind of close and near and dear to my heart because I am a child of divorce. So when I was in law school, I sampled a bunch of different fields. I tried plaintiff's work. I tried defense work. And then an opportunity came up for me to clerk during law school for a firm, and I clerked for another firm that I love, Kessler & Solmiani downtown, during my third year. And I just loved it. I just loved the people and the issues, and they were just everyday issues that everyone goes through and my own family had gone through. So it just became something that, you know, I liked going to work every day.
And you mentioned defense. Was that what area? Was it criminal defense? Or
I think I did insurance defense. Okay. It was during my second year of law school.
Okay. And we've had Mr. Randy Kessler in here a number of times.
I bet you have.
He loves coming on the show. We love having you all in here. So I know you can't mention maybe specific cases, but is there a certain, you know, focus of your practice?
I think that I've kind of fallen into the niche of child custody mostly. Our firm handles a lot of middle income, high asset divorces. Not to say that we don't do all, but that is kind of where we end up specializing. And then I just was privileged to work with some lawyers who really got me involved in child custody cases, which are by far, in my opinion, the most emotionally grueling and complex. The daily grind of custody cases is very intense. So there's a lot of working with your clients every single day on issues that are very small, you know, pickups and drop-offs and clothing exchanges and things that you wouldn't necessarily think are important. But in the context of that kind of case, they can really make a difference. You wouldn't believe it. So there's a lot of constant interaction with clients.
I imagine one of the keys there is, like Mark was talking about, is communication.
That's
right. Got to be the biggest challenge between the parents, right?
Communication is a challenge for a lot of divorcing parents, and even people who haven't been married especially really have difficulty with the communication, and they don't agree, shocker.
Right.
They get divorced, and there may be huge issues like, where's the child going to go to school? Should they have a certain medical procedure? Those kinds of things that the courts look at are really important for the parents to communicate. So I actually wrote that down when Mark said that, because that is very important with my own clients. And I encourage my clients to communicate with one another, because that can sometimes be the thing that turns the case around, your communication skills with your other party.
Absolutely. So if you're keeping score, Mark, 2 points for you, right? Exactly. So you mentioned folks or parents that have not been married but have kids. You wouldn't, you know, that doesn't normally come right to the surface when you think about family issues and divorce, family law, and child custody, specifically what you're talking about. So is that a completely different dynamic? I mean, I don't want to get into too much legal minutia, but as a civilian, I'm thinking, how do they determine, is it this kind of the same process to determine who gets custody?
It really depends. It depends on the relationship of the parents and some things that they have done. So the issues might not all be the same if you're right. dealing with people who haven't been married. And, you know, we just had a pretty large Supreme Court case come down from this, from the United States Supreme right. Court, that is really going to have an impact on a lot of people in Atlanta who, before that opinion, were not recognized as married right. or not able to marry. So they're going to be falling into that category of, what do we do now, especially with our children? So the biggest issue between people who are not married is support and custody, obviously. So they just have a different set of considerations and different set of things that they might be have going on in their case. But under Georgia law, each party is, you know, as long as the child is legitimated and both parties have established their rights to the child, which is more difficult for the father, obviously. He's the one that's going to have to come forward and do something to legitimate a child. They're on equal footing. As far as the court's concerned, it's best interest of the child to see where they should be. So that is a case that I've had pretty often, actually, fathers coming forward and legitimating. And I helped one gentleman up in Gwinnett County get custody of a one-year-old girl,
wow.
which from the mother, which was pretty, it was a pretty significant case.
And they don't have to go on Maury Povich or whatever?
No. They could if they wanted, I guess.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. There's DNA testing anywhere, right? Yeah.
You can request one, but most
TV.
Of the time, you'd be shocked at how many people decline that request.
Really?
I know. I've seen it. No. He looks just like my baby pictures.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, you could. That's crazy, because you could spend a whole lifetime and money and emotion and everything else and without any clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So other activities you get involved in besides what we just spoke about with child custody?
I really enjoy being involved in the State Bar, the Young Lawyers Division.
Okay.
I didn't realize Mark was a member of Lawyers Club of Atlanta. I think that's a great organization. I'm a member of that as well. We have some really fun events, but I just like, this is, sounds weird probably to everybody, but I like socializing with other lawyers. I, you know, I always have stuff to talk about with other lawyers. The law is very interesting to me. Just listening to all these different, it's just amazing how specialized each field can be. You have, I mean, she's talking about all this asbestos litigation,
right.
and all these details. I just would never know things like that. Or, you know, if you get hurt at work, it would never occur to me to, you know, go see a doctor, that it has to be approved by my employer. So there are just so many considerations of things that I just find interesting. So I love doing stuff with the Young Lawyers Division. I am co-chair of the Family Law Committee. So we do a lot of things with Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation. We've started a kind of series of Meet the Judges events so that we can all get to know the judges outside of the shadow of our partners and people who already kind of, you know, take the spotlight. But our biggest event that we sponsor every year is the Supreme Court event, which y'all might have been to. You need to come to it.
Okay,
if
I'm
you
in.
Haven't yet.
Yeah, I was going to join the Young Lawyers Division. That sounds like a lot of fun, but I'm not a lawyer and I'm not young, so I probably wouldn't qualify.
But we host a fundraiser every year at the West Side. Five Seasons Brewery,
yeah,
West
yeah.
Side. I'm sorry, it's early. Okay. And we raise a lot of money for Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation, which, as you know, needs all the help they can get financially. So it's a silent auction, you know, wine tasting, things like that.
Nice.
We have fun.
I'm in. And they did also a big event recently where it was they helped fund the food banks or what was that? It was a food drive just for all the
Legal Food Frenzy.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is really an initiative of Sam Olens, the attorney general, yeah. really pushes that. I have some good friends who are on that committee. So they raise a lot of money for the food banks and you know, food drives, canned right. food, things like that.
Yeah, we were pretty excited with, 44,000 attorneys in the state of Georgia. We had the attorney general sit right here yeah. in our studio for an hour. So that was pretty exciting.
He's an exciting person to listen to.
Yeah.
He really is.
And I think he was here for that food drive to kind of help get the word out. On that, so so talk to us about a memorable case or a win, you know, something a feather in your cap, if you will, that turned out well.
Well, a lot of mine. I was thinking about that when y'all asked me, and it's the one I mentioned about the father in Gwinnett County. Is really near and dear to my heart because that was a struggle. I mean, to get to legitimate a child and then take custody of an infant from not take custody, but you know what I mean. For him to be awarded custody of right. his daughter from the mother was a pretty significant victory. And I have her picture on my wall.
Wow.
I actually have a wall of children who
nice.
Are my kids in my cases. And so I've actually, I don't know why it's fallen this way, but I have helped a lot of fathers
right.
win custody of their children,
right.
so, which is encouraging that the judges in the Metro Atlanta County are being more open to fathers coming forward and stepping up to be primary custodians.
Yeah, because I think the perception is just arbitrarily it's going to go to the mom, right? Traditionally, it always has, it seems like, right? It seems like it is a battle.
I think that there is an inherent bias
right.
In favor of mothers. But, you know, there is no presumption in favor of a mother. So it's really what's best for the child. And a lot of times there is an increase in stay-at-home dads. There's
right.
an increase in dual parent income households where they're both working. So you have to be creative with a lot of families.
It really has to, as opposed to generations in the past, it really has to really, each case has to stand on its own, right? But that's got to be the toughest thing. I wouldn't want to be involved almost in any part of that decision to decide, you know, this person is better fit than that person. And obviously they're going to each plead their case. I mean, how do you decide, I mean, that's kind of
that decision is harder than you think sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes there is no good choice.
Right.
I do guardian ad litem work as well. So for people who don't know, a guardian ad litem is essentially an attorney for the child who goes in, is appointed by the court to do an investigation. They will talk to witnesses. They'll talk to the parties. They do a home study. Most of the time there is a cost involved unless it's provided through Atlanta Voluntary Lawyers Foundation. And there have been times where I lost sleep over it at night. You just, you know, you can't decide. And sometimes you have two good parents and it's just a matter of, that's why I said earlier, sometimes these little bitty facts, you know, who's the most cooperative,
right.
who's better at sharing information, things that you wouldn't necessarily think would be important. They can tip the scale in favor of a parent. I do not envy judges at all for having to make those decisions.
I mean, there's so many moving parts and pieces to this, right? Because then you have the kids. We haven't even really talked about the kids and their aspect or their involvement or their input.
Mm-hmm.
But all the parties are potentially kind of at their worst, right? So
right.
you're catching somebody that, you know, a year ago or a year or 5 years a window would have been a completely different person. Now you put them in this circumstance and they're not acting like themselves. And yet you're kind of judging this must be the way they fly off the handle or react or whatever, right? And then I don't know if we have time, but talk about like the kids, how involved are you or other parties, I guess the ad litem, but in determining the kids, the psychological state and, you know, I mean, there's so much at play because obviously each of the parents potentially are kind of pitting, you know, one against the other. I mean, how do you, what are some guidelines or, I mean, or what are some things you, how do you determine, you know, kind of work through all that?
that is something that comes with experience, yeah. I think, and working with the families. But it's interesting you talk about people kind of changing when the case starts, because they do. A lot of times people who weren't involved realize, oh my goodness, I'm about to go through this divorce. Right. I need to really step it up. And that could be a number of reasons why they would do that. Some good motivating factors and some bad. But with the children, it is very clear, I think, as the case progresses, when you start seeing signs of stress in the children. And a lot of signs that I coach my clients to look for is sleeplessness. Sometimes they have behavioral changes. They start acting out in school. A lot of times my clients will tell me my child is more fussy. They stop eating. Yep. Sometimes it's small things. Sometimes it's big things. But the people who are with their children every day know what their children are like. So what I like to do, I do not have interaction with the children. I don't feel like it's appropriate as the attorney. So I don't do that unless it's absolutely necessary. And usually it's with an older child, 16, 17 year old. So what I do, I like to go ahead and send my clients to a child counselor. And there are a number of fantastic counselors in this area. And they really are more equipped to deal with that thing. So if you start seeing signs of stress in your child, you shouldn't hesitate. And a lot of times, the counselor is going to be an essential witness in court.
Sure.
Speaking to the guardian or otherwise.
Okay, so finish on a lighter note. So,
I know, it's heavy. Larry, it's a lot every day.
You warned us, yeah. So how often do, in a divorce, a family issue, do the pets become involved?
More often than you would think, okay? People treat their pets like their children. In fact, my dog is in my divorce decree, so that, you know, everyone knows that he's mine. A lot of people do fight over their pets, so they're part of the family. And I've had expense provisions for pets, you know, make sure that these expenses are covered when we're calculating support. So
a little facetiously, but you know, there must be a point. It'd be probably like on a sitcom or something like that, where the parents would say, "The teenagers, they're just trouble. You know what? You can take the teenagers. I want the family dog." Right?
Mm-hmm. People fight over the dog for sure.
No, I can imagine that. So finally, you have some occasions where you speak, and you have a publication that you're publishing. Tell us about that, or what?
My firm is really good about just getting different issues out. I recently wrote an article that was on Fox Business about habits of financially savvy 20-somethings, which I was very lucky to get some good financial guidance. And it's something that can help some of my clients, especially the younger ones, 20s, early 30s, just kind of start planning for the future. We regularly participate in the Atlanta Family Lawyer, which is the publication of the family law section of the Atlanta Bar. I've written articles for that as well, and I've been very privileged to be given the opportunity to speak at seminars, which are listed on my website, bcntlaw.com. It's Boyd Collar Nolan Tuggle Law.com, about various topics, appeals, finances, child custody, just the gamut of things.
And that was my final question. Mm-hmm. You may have just shared with our audience as well, but that's the best way for listeners to get in touch with you.
Right. Our office number is 770-953-4300, and they need to ask for Katie K, because there's two of us.
And your fax number? No.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for being here, Katie. And up next, our anchor man, as we like to say, our final panelist here in the studio, patiently standing by, is Mr. Christensen. I graduated from Emory University Law School in 1976.
I'm no longer a member of the Younger Lawyers.
Yeah, me neither. I missed that window. Yeah, I didn't even have a chance. All right. And so your law practice is limited to injury and disability law, which represent individuals, like we mentioned earlier at the top of the show, regarding Social Security disability claims, as well as children's disability claims. Social Security overpayment issue. Case, overpayment? Is that possible? Or what?
Well,
did I read that right?
It is. Sometimes people, for example, return to work and make a little bit too much money. And
that can come back at them.
So that can come back and bite them. That's right. Correct.
That's why I always get my Social Security in cash.
There you go.
But you've published numerous articles relating to these areas, participated in seminar presentations for medical providers, members of the bar, and other organizations. You're also a member of the National Organization for Social Security Claimants Representatives, the American, Georgia, and Cobb Bar Associations. And you live and practice mostly in Cobb or Marietta, right?
Well, I live in Marietta, and that's right. Where our office is. But Social Security disability cases are part of a federal program. And so actually we find ourselves in many different counties in the state.
Sure.
And sometimes out of state.
All right. So so we talked earlier about the distinctions between the two. So how do I qualify for Social Security disability income?
Well, Social Security disability income, the economic qualifier is that you've worked a certain period of time and have earned work credits.
Okay.
And when you have a sufficient number of those, then the question becomes if you have a physical or a mental impairment or a combination of both, which precludes not only the kind of work that you used to do, but any other work in the national economy, or which might result in death, then those are basically the criteria. Number one, am I insured for benefits? And number two, do I have a really serious medical problem?
So you talked about accumulating these credits. So how many, you know, quarters or how many years does that entail?
Well, basically, it becomes a little technical. It's 20 out of 40 quarters.
Okay.
In other words, if you worked up until pretty steadily up until the end of 2010, then for the next 5 years, you would still remain covered.
Oh, covered, even if you're unemployed or not working as often.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And sometimes people stop work because they're just simply not able to work anymore, but maybe they have long-term disability benefits and they don't think to file for Social Security. And so, you know, they don't necessarily have to file for benefits during the period that they're covered. They just have to show that I was covered.
Sure.
Back when I became disabled.
And so the ballpark number is about the five-year window. And being employed primarily full time to acquire those credits.
To acquire
but potentially you could be part time, but probably over a longer period of time.
Yeah, I mean this year, if you work and earn $1,220,
right,
that's a work credit.
Okay.
You know, 10 years ago it was about $960,
right,
equal to credit. So a person theoretically could work for a month.
Right.
Earn $4,600, $4,800 and have four work credits for that year.
Right.
And since the IRS used to, and Social Security used to look at quarterly wages, now they just look at annual wages.
Okay. So talked about disability and, you know, how does a person determine that they're actually, you know, defined as disabled?
Well, it's a very interesting situation. There are probably some 250 diseases.
Really?
Yeah, which the Social Security Administration has said, if you've got one of these, you're automatically entitled to benefits, okay? They're very serious diseases, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, Crutchfield-Jakob's disease, and certain types of inflammatory breast cancer that is not resectable or non-operable and is spread to other sites in the body. But there are 250 of these, which physicians would probably recognize, but the rest of us can't pronounce.
Right, right. I don't know if this is a fair question, but in terms of disability, how often is it more an issue of disease as opposed to like what Mark was talking about, injured, you know, physically injured on a job or?
Well, that's an interesting question because the format that Social Security goes through is a five-step format. Are you working?
Okay.
Do you have a serious impairment? If you do have a serious impairment, is it one which the federal rules recognize that as a matter of law, if you have this problem, you're entitled?
Right.
Period. It's only, you know, but most people don't have those types of diseases, number one. Number two, I very seldom see them because if they do have that disease, they don't need to come to me.
Right.
So it's the people who, you know, maybe the truck driver who has a very bad back or bad knees and can't drive a truck anymore, and is 60 years old and thinks that he can't do anything else. We look at, you know, that what we call the vocational factors.
Right.
Given your age, your education, your work experience, can you make a reasonable transition to other work? And the older you get, the harder it is to make that transition.
And who determines that, Hiro?
Well, in the initial instance, it's the Social Security Disability Adjudication Section. And, you know, when one files an initial application, it will take approximately 6 to 8 months for them to get around to making a determination. Well, there are thousands and thousands of cases that are filed in the Atlanta area each month.
Right.
So, you know, it's standing in line.
Yeah.
And if they make a determination that the person is not disabled, now, footnote, people think that you're always going to be denied the first time. That's simply not correct.
That's been my perception of people that had some family members, and it just seemed like that was the stamp they go to. There's more ink on that rubber stamp than there is on the other.
Well, sometimes that's the case, but in approximately 30% of the cases, 30% of the people who apply get it. But those are the people with very, very serious diseases, whether physical or mental.
Right.
The 70% that don't get it, many of them don't appeal, but those who do go on to the next step, which is called a reconsideration.
Right.
That takes another, oftentimes, 6 months on average. And typically, not many people are granted disability at the reconsideration.
Really?
Well, it's reviewed by the same group of folks.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And so we told you weren't disabled. That's kind of what we meant. And
well, it seems like you'd want a second opinion. What's the purpose of just going back to the same person?
Well,
right?
That's why the next step is before an administrative law judge.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, at this point in time, in the Atlanta office downtown and in the Atlanta hearing office in North Atlanta, the wait time is about 18 months for a hearing.
So, you know, you're doing the math, 6 months here, 8 months there, 18 months. What do folks do in the interim, in the meanwhile?
We don't have an answer for that.
Wow.
You know, this
I appreciate your frankness. I mean,
this is the system. It really is. And not too many years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, if a person came to my office and said, you know, I need to request a hearing, I've been denied twice.
Right.
So we file a request for a hearing. And the person expectantly says to me, how long do I have to wait for my hearing? And I would have told him about 3 years.
That's crazy.
It is. It's awful. And the administration came under a great deal of pressure to resolve that delay. And they first started dealing with what they called the 1,000-day cases.
Right.
People who had been waiting for over 1,000 days for their hearing. And then they worked on the 900-day cases, the 800-day cases. And in Atlanta, we're basically around 520 days.
Relatively speaking, where it's...
Relatively,
when you put it
in that
perspective, it doesn't seem so bad. But I mean, there's never a simple solution to things, but it could be as simple as just hiring more, doubling or tripling.
Well, it could.
But where's the money going to come from, right?
Yeah, but that's exactly it. You know, you're going to get Congress to spend more money on disabled people. I mean, right now
just on the staff that are processing
on the staff that are processing
the backlog.
Exactly. But now the emphasis of the administration is to take a review,
right,
another look at those people who are receiving Social Security disability to determine whether or not they're still entitled. So that's the big push now.
Because it kind of could be the 80-20 rule, because then you end up, if we bring it down from 18 months down to 2 or 3 months, then more people would say, their neighbors are going to be like, hey, I got, you know, disability in just a couple of months. So then more people are going to potentially flood and get in line. Yes or yes?
Well, I guess it's a question of public perception.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, not everybody wants to apply for disability benefits,
yeah.
But those who do, it can become a grueling process for them. And, I mean, it's very hard to tell people, you know, who want to feed their kids and keep them living indoors.
Right. Well, that period of time, it just sounds like, you know...
It's very difficult.
Big time. So you talked about also the children. We've been thinking in a lot of terms, in terms of the elderly person or the current, the adult, someone currently employed.
Sure.
But there's issues with autism and the children. I mean, speak to that issue.
Sure. Well, you know, people think that if my child has a diagnosis of autism, then he or she is entitled. And that's not necessarily so. The question is, what is the degree?
Right.
For example, if we took a look at all five of us here sitting around the table, every one of us has some degree of cardiac dysfunction.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Right.
But it's not severe enough to qualify us for benefits, you know?
That's a
and
good
so
point.
Kids on the autism spectrum,
right,
may have a touch of autism or may be severely disabled because of it. You know, it's something that we look at the medical records. We look at the school records to see if there are individual educational plans that have been set up for the child because of the, you know, the physical or mental problems that
right.
he or she has.
So let's figure they met those requirements. Then what's next?
Well, the next question is, since they don't have work credits.
Right. I know. These kids these days, slackers.
That's yeah. right. You know, 5 years old and they just haven't worked.
They haven't done anything. Come on.
So the question is, what is the parent income?
Right.
What's the household income? And as I said, SSI is a welfare program. SSI right. is a program for people who are economically at the lowest end of the spectrum.
Right.
And so those children can become eligible for SSI benefits if the household income is low enough. And it
right.
usually relates to the federal poverty level or some fraction of that.
And what are those numbers roughly?
Well, you know, it can range. A person in a one-parent household
right.
with one disabled child and one non-disabled child, the income level, you know, might go up to the $3,000 range per month before they are no longer qualified.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a sliding scale.
And it would probably vary state to state as well, right, based on the cost of living?
Well, not only that, but because SSI is a joint program between the state and federal government, and so one state may be a little bit more generous than the other.
Right. I'm afraid we're going to have you back on another show here.
Be delighted to come.
There's a lot to cover here, and we just kind of scratched the surface.
Right, we did.
But
so it's a rewarding practice that we have. I remember particularly one older gentleman. Doesn't seem so old now.
Right. It's already, right.
But when I was younger and in practice, he had tried repeatedly over and over and over to get Social Security disability, but he couldn't read and write. And so when he got the denial notices, he didn't know what to do. And so the
things we take for granted.
Things that we take for granted. And he was in his mid-50s and never been to school. So he called our office, and we We helped him get benefits. We actually helped him get benefits retroactive to the first time that he applied.
Right.
And he called up and said, I got this notice from Social Security. What does it say? And I said, it says that you won. And he says, oh, great. Are my benefits going to be radioactive? And we assured him that they would be.
As opposed to retroactive.
As opposed to retroactive. Yeah. He kind of knew what he wanted to say.
Right. Yeah, because he might not know the word denied as opposed to no. They don't say yes or no.
No, they don't.
All right. Larry, pleasure talking with you. And just I'm amazed at some of the numbers you've shared and the insight. I mean, it's both interesting and compelling to take some action. Seems like, you know, that's a tough issue.
It is a tough issue. My law partner, who is just absolutely wonderful human being and a great lawyer, said when she came to interview that she wanted to represent underrepresented people.
Right.
I said, lady, you've come to the right office.
Absolutely. Speaking of your office, how would listeners get in touch with you?
Well, they would get in touch with us by phone at 770-422-8111. And either Casey or Martha will answer the phone and do an interview.
Okay.
And then Angel, my law partner, Angel and I meet with them every day.
Wow.
You know, to review, you know, what's come in. And then we return the call to the client to talk a little bit more to them about their situation.
Well, it seems to be a theme here this morning that got started, that with all the technology we have, it's hard to replace that phone call and that
it
conversation
is.
To hear a voice on the other
right.
end, compassion, right. and also that they understand. Because a lot of times when we're dealing online, you send an email or you communicate with an entity, and they don't seem to connect the dots. And when you're on the phone, they're like, okay, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, and we also have them into the office as early as possible so we can kind of eyeball each other.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so Rich Casanova here once again for Atlanta Legal Experts. Another episode comes to a close. We want to thank our sponsors, Peachtree Offices, 3A Law Practice Management, Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, Equitable Payments, Golden Pear Funding, and U.S. Legal Support. Also, you can find all their information at AtlantaLegalExperts.com, as well as all our guest information from this week's episode. We'll see y'all next week on Atlanta Legal Experts Radio Show.